Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony, and for this episode, I'm very, very happy to have back a very special guest, because he was one of the first guests I've ever had in the Cave of Solitude, and that was at 2015 Toronto Comic Con, episode 17, and I'm very happy he's back again. It's long overdue. It's Mr. Sam Agro. Sam, thank you for coming back to the show. How are you doing?
I am great, Eric. Thanks for having me back on.
How has your 2020 been so far? I know it's been a crazy year, and it's one of those questions that I've asked all of the guests this year, but how can you not ask everybody what their experience has been like?
Yeah, you know, it's been a challenging year, just like it has been for everyone. You know, we're quite fortunate. My wife has continued to work. They switched her to working from home. She sells advertising for Zoomer magazine. And so she's continued to work, so that's been good. And I had a bit of a, I was finished my last animation job, but I had a bit of a nest egg set aside, which I've been drawing from. And so financially for us, things have been good. The only real problem is, you know, just being inside all the time. And even though I'm a nerd and I love my books and my comics and my Netflix, you know, I also used to like to get out. I'm pretty gregarious, so I like to get out and hang around with my friends and go see movies and stuff like that. And, you know, after a while, it gets, you know, kind of depressing that you can't do those things. But generally speaking, I've been doing well and trying to keep myself busy with personal projects, and it's been all right.
Yeah, that's good. At the beginning, I know my wife was really excited for, you know, the simplifying of life. She's never not worked since she was 14, 15 years old. So her being able to stay home for a couple months, because she works in the healthcare field, she was... the dental aspect of it, not the actual, she's not a nurse working in a hospital, so she had to stay home for a couple months, and she was enjoying that simplified sort of life, being able to cook dinner and those type of things. So it was a nice little reset. But you're right, that point where you get to where it's like, okay, like I miss going to the movies, I miss going to the bookstore, like when are we going to get to that again?
Yeah, you're ready to get back to it, but you know, these things, they take as long as they take. So, you know, all we can do is sort of make the best of it.
The one thing that I've become more and more grateful for is where we live. When you look at the rest of the world and when you look at our neighbors just down south, you realize, you know what, we did pretty good. And
yeah, you know, Canada didn't do too bad in their response to this pandemic. And you know, I mean, not to say we couldn't have done better, maybe, but we did pretty well. And I think, you know, Canadians are pretty level-headed people. And I think for the most part, you know, there's a few agitators don't think they should be wearing masks or following any kind of rules if they don't want to. But, you know, I think for the most part, Canadians have been compliant with the, you know, the safety measures. And that's what's helped make such a big difference up here. And, you know, certainly in other countries, that hasn't been the case, although many countries have done even better than we did, but certainly many did worse. So, you know, I mean, it's a good country to live in still, and I hope, you know, it continues to be that way.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, it's funny when people bring up the mask issue, it's not like anybody is excited to wear the masks, but we do like going outside. And if I can go and do my grocery shopping and they say just wear a mask and you can come in, fine. I don't want to, but it's like the alternative is ridiculous at this point. So let's just cooperate and be able to get to some semblance of order again.
Well, I certainly agree with that. So yeah. I'm ready for everybody to just do it and get the numbers down to zero, and then, you know, it's more likely we can get back to normal.
Yeah. We always get to see each other at the numerous shows that we have in Toronto, the Comic Cons and Fan Expo. And I was saying to you before when we did that first take of recording, before it got interrupted by technology, You were the first artist at the shows in 2012, 2013, who kind of opened me up to how fun the Comic Cons could be, because I got my first commission from you. My first interview, like I said, for the podcast was with you, and it really did change the way that I approached being an artist alley, and I used to go for, one day to the con and just buy whatever books I could get for cheap, but it opened me up to appreciating the show so much more when you have a good experience with an artist. So thank you for that.
Well, you're very welcome, and I'm glad you had a good experience with it. As I was saying before, I have been with that convention since before it was even the Fan Expo. So going back 30 years, I think,
Wow.
to it. And because I'm 60 now. I'm going to actually be 60 next month. So it's a very, I have a really warm feeling about that convention. It's very personal to me because I kind of grew up with it, and as a guest. And if I can sort of spread that feeling of really enjoying myself there, that's great. I mean, I love to get people interested not only in comics and all the other nerd pursuits that they represent at Fan Expo now. But also, in the convention and the joys of the convention itself, that's fantastic. I love that.
Do you miss it right now, or did you enjoy doing the cons, or was it something that was it was because you were attached to it was good for work and things like that, or do you miss it?
Well, I went through a bit of a dry spell in my professional life. For a lot, I originally started out in the animation business, and I worked in animation for a long, long time. And then I sort of got tired of animation. I was a bit disillusioned with how they ran companies and so forth. I had been getting on the side some live action storyboard work. And I just one day made a shift completely from animation over to live action. And that was a really good job for about 10 years. And then it started to kind of fall apart for various reasons. One is that they don't storyboard the way they used to in live action. It used to be my bread and butter was movies made for TV movies because they were shot in a very short period of time and they had to plan out very carefully what they were going to shoot. So I would do, it was usually just whatever scene involved some kind of action, and that was a lot of the work I did. And also, I did a lot of work for commercials, shooting storyboards for shooting commercials. And basically, both of those areas dried up because of digital technology. People don't storyboard for TV movies anymore. Sorry, I've got
No, that's the city. We're in the city.
going by. People don't storyboard so much for made for TV movies now because they have digital stock. So they don't have to pay for the film stock and they don't have to pay for the processing. And the editing process is much simpler. So they tend to shoot more and then let the editors figure it out rather than planning beforehand, which is what the storyboard is for. And the sort of the same thing happened in commercials because the storyboard was a way that different directors would pitch their vision of what they would do with a given commercial concept. And after a while, the budgets for television advertising started to shrink, and the storyboard aspect was just kind of phased out. The director would get his assistant and go to a location and take a few photos of him and put that in his pitch, and rather than pay me as the storyboard guy. So I had a few lean years there, and during the time, I wasn't making a lot of money from that. It was very important for me to make money at the convention, and I enjoyed the convention so much less when I was sort of worried about how much money I was going to make, right? So, after about 4 years ago, I got back into the animation business, and started making a pretty good living there again. And suddenly going to the convention was so much more fun because I didn't feel that pressure of trying to sell one more sketch or, you know, or one more book. And I could sort of relax and enjoy it. And if I had a good day of sales, that's great. If I didn't have a good day of sales, it wasn't going to hurt me financially and I didn't have to worry about it. So I prefer, that's the situation I prefer.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. How do you adjust with having been a traditional artist, I guess, or an animator and comic book artist over the years to now there being all of this new digital technology? Have you been able to, do you still prefer drawing the traditional way, or have you adjusted to doing things on a digital platform?
Well, I've definitely adjusted. I don't know if I've adjusted well, but my preference is still to get out a piece of paper and draw a picture. You know, that's still the way that I like to do it, with pencils and paper and ink or paint or whatever. But when I got back into animation, one of the reasons I had hesitated to get back into animation was because I didn't know how to do anything in the computer, really. I didn't have any of that skill set. But I was teaching, there's an animation school here in Toronto called Max the Mutt. And I was teaching a few classes there. And at the end of the semester, they always have an industry night where industry people come and look at the portfolios of some of the recent graduates. And I just attended because I was teaching at the school. And I ran into an old friend of mine from animation, a fellow named George Elliott. And he said, you know, how are things going? I said, hey, not great. I'm kind of starving because live action boarding has dried up and I'm not making enough money. And he said, well, why don't you get back into animation? I said, I can't. I don't know how to use any of the programs. I don't have enough money to buy the programs, to learn to use the program, you know. And he said, well, listen, we're between projects. He runs an animation studio. He said, we're between projects. Come on down, play around with some programs, learn to draw on the Cintiq. You know, they're sitting there with nobody using them. And what a generous, generous thing to do. I went down. I started playing around with Storyboard Pro and Photoshop and Illustrator and some other programs. And I got comfortable drawing on the Cintiq, you know, drawing digitally. And I went down a couple of days a week for about 3 months. I went down and just practiced at his studio while they were between jobs. And then they got some work, and he said, do you want to work on this? And I said, absolutely. And that's how I got back into the animation business. So a very big favor from an old friend made a huge difference in my life at an important time. So thanks, George.
That's great. Yeah, that's a great story. What was it that you started working on when you got back into the animation?
Well, the very first thing that I worked on was a season of Fairly Odd Parents. Remember that cartoon?
Okay.
Fairly Odd Parents. Nickelodeon gave George that program, project, I think, to sort of test them for another project that they were developing. Mm. And they did a great job, and I worked on that in the art department and background, and it worked out very well. They were very happy with the work. And then so immediately after that, they got a new show that they had developed called Bunsen is a Beast, which unfortunately they only did one season of. So that was the second thing I worked on. And then I moved on to another company and I worked on a show called DNAce. And I worked on that for almost 2 years, for about 2 months shy of 2 years, I worked on that show. So those are the only three shows that I've worked on since I've been back in the business. But in the old days, I worked on Ewoks and Droids, and I worked on Care Bears and, Teddy Ruxpin and Little Rosie and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and
very cool,
all different stuff.
Very cool. What can you, for someone like me who doesn't know, can you explain what the process is for somebody in your position, what they'd be doing when it comes to animation and in that department and putting together, let's say, an episode of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
Well, I was storyboarding on that particular show. So what that is it's the visual blueprint. So when I was working on, I think it was Wolf Films or Murakami Wolf, did the original Ninja Turtle show. But they would send me what we used to in the business called a fun pack, and it would have the script for the show that I was going to work on, and it would have the any new designs. Like I also get another package of all the standard designs, like the underground lair and the sewers where the turtles are. That was already pre-designed, so I would get a package with all of that stuff and all the main characters that are going to be used in all the various episodes. But for a specific episode, I would get a script and I would get any new characters or locations that are unique to that new script, and then it's my job to sort of visually interpret, shot by shot and action by action, what's going to happen in that episode, in these little, sort of, comic strip panels, so that the next phase of the process, which is background department and animation, kind of knew what was going on. And of course, directors get in there and they tweak things after you storyboard it, and each department tries to, if possible, make everything a little bit better as they go along, or at least that's the idea. Unfortunately, in mainstream production, that's not always possible. But they try to plus it, is what we say, or what we used to say in the animation business, is try and plus it, make it better every step of the way. And sometimes there's just no time or money to do that, but sometimes it turns out better than you expect. The storyboard artist's job was to kind of be that first blueprint of what the shots are going to be. Where do we have a wide shot? Where do we have a close up? Where do we have a pan? Where do we have a push in or a pull out? And what's the action being played out? You're posing out that action, roughly posing it out. So
So it's kind of like breakdowns and layouts for a comic book. Is it kind of the same principle?
yeah, it's similar to that. Yeah, exactly. It's like the plan. This is the plan. And then in comic books, you'd have an inker come in, and he would plus it
That's it,
to
right?
add detail if it's a breakdown, or if it's full pencils, he would have a little bit more to work with and would have a little less to make up himself. But I don't think they really do breakdowns so much anymore. But back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they used to do it that way quite frequently. These days, I think most pencilers pencil pretty tight for comic books, but there may still be a few guys out there that are letting the inker pick up the slack.
Do
They get the
you
character for that.
miss those days where you did have the specific inker and the penciler? Because I feel that the same artist could sometimes have a different tone to his style based on that inker. Or it would enhance, maybe give his art that extra boost that you like. I liked when, for me, I always see the difference between, let's say, a Ron Frenz working with a Brett Breeding, and then I saw the difference when he worked with a Joe Sinnott. Both are exceptional, but you can see it's still Ron Frenz, but you can see a lot of the inker's influence in that work.
I think inkers today tend to have less influence than they did back in the sort of silver and bronze ages. I think, as I said, I think a lot of the pencilers these days tend to pencil more of a tight kind of picture, with the blacks all spotted and all of that. Whereas, in the old days, part of it was that they wanted to get their pencilers to do as many pages as possible.
Right.
So they might do, breakdowns as opposed to finished pencils. And then a good inker, a talented inker who was sort of an artist in his own right. And I'm not suggesting that modern inkers aren't artists too. They are, of course.
Of course.
But, I think now trying to reflect the penciler's style is more important than kind of inking the way you ink or the way you think it looks good, right. Which was kind of the way it was done in the Bronze Age, which is the age that I was, you know, discovering comics and learning about them. So it's different for sure. I don't know if I prefer one or the other, mm-hmm. But there was the interesting thing then was if you had a different inker on a book, it could look quite a bit different.
Yes.
Today, I think that the differences are more subtle, not quite so obvious, because they're trying to reflect or trying to adhere more closely to the pencils. So, you know, both have their place, I think. But, you know, I think we all love most the things that we grew up with, right? So for me, you know, that late 60s through 70s and 80s era, that's when I really was heavily most into comics. And so I miss the inker that you go, oh, that's so-and-so's inks.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's a certain charm to it, especially when you can... I mean, I love being able to see an artist's work, not see the name and be able to guess who it is. But then back in that era when you even, you know, everything's collected now. So you're able to see a lot of those books reformatted and collected. You're able to kind of see, oh, that was John Byrne with Terry Austin as opposed to, you know, another person with the artist. And you got to see the value of what they brought to certain books. There was a nice little touch to that. So yeah, there's a charm to it. I agree. And you're partial to your era. It's true.
Yeah. Everybody loves the stuff that they grew up with. I think that's always their most, you know, somebody once said, I think, I don't know who, but they said the golden age of everything is 13 and referring to your age, you know, so whatever you were into when you were 13, is kind of what you kind of covet the most because, it's sort of when you were, you know, diving into it and getting that first taste of it. And it's always sort of got a supremacy in your mind. So yeah, I mean, I like all those guys that really made their mark during the late 60s and 70s, you know, John Buscema and Bernie Wrightson and, Mike Ploog and, Mike Kaluta and, All those guys that came up during that era. I mean, John Buscema was a little bit earlier, but he really made his mark after Kirby left Marvel. Yeah. That's when he took over all the big books that Kirby had been doing and kind of, you know, cemented himself as one of the big guys. So so I remember him as part of that era.
Yeah. Now that all, like, mentioning those names, now that Marvel and DC are collecting a lot of their back catalog in these nice books, whether it be an omnibus or Marvel has like those epic collections, looking at, you know, somebody like a John Buscema, I can really appreciate his full storytelling abilities. Whereas before you would see snapshots and pictures of comic book covers sometimes, and if you were lucky you could get a little collection of them, but now you've got these full runs of seeing his work, and he was tremendous. Like he's even when I think of like Silver Surfer, we know Kirby created the Surfer and Galactus and all of those, you know, Fantastic Four, but I don't know if I'd rather see a Silver Surfer drawn by Jack Kirby as much as I'd like to see it from John Buscema.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes the originator of a product or a character isn't necessarily, you know, the definitive artist for it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I love Jack Kirby. I came to appreciate Jack Kirby later because, you know, when I was sort of in my teens, you know, that style of his didn't appeal to me as much. You know, I was more into a Bernie Wrightson or a Neil Adams who were doing more detailed kind of work. Later as I got into my 20s and I sort of studied art myself and kind of realized, oh, okay, I see what Jack's doing now.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of the Silver Surfer, it's hard to say whether, you know, more people appreciate the character in Jack Kirby's hands or John Buscema's hands. Buscema certainly drew more pages of him, right, you know, overall. So that helps too to kind of cement him as the definitive artist. But, you know,
It's up for debate.
It's always up for debate, man.
Yeah, that's the fun part, right?
People don't like Buscema at all. You know, I've talked
That's
to a few people
interesting.
like that, and there are still people who don't like Kirby even. So, you know,
Yeah.
I don't understand, but you know, there are people like that out there. So.
I've always encountered a lot of people who have that similar experience saying that they didn't like Jack Kirby in the beginning. They thought it was, somewhat childish or too simple. And they mention all those people that you mentioned, Neil Adams and John Buscema and Wrightson. But then I found that I appreciated Jack Kirby not so much by reading all of his books, but from all of the artists who worked on the things that he became famous for. So when I read, Walt Simonson's Thor, I saw where he was trying to channel certain things that Kirby would have done, or even Mike Allred doing Silver Surfer. Kirby had these like different tones of and shapes depending again who was inking him, but there's certain things that you connect to him. And whether it was extremely detailed, the way John Byrne's Fantastic Four was sometimes extremely detailed in the machinery, was very Kirby-like. But then there was also a very simplistic style that he would do that you'd see some other guys do as well. And I started to see, well, all these guys in some way are trying to channel what he did. So whether or not I realize it, I do like Kirby through these artists.
Well, he was influential on almost all of them.
Right.
I mean, it's a little tricky to see where Kirby influenced somebody like Neil Adams or Bernie Wrightson
Right.
because they've gone to a more decorative or semi-photorealistic kind of approach. Although Bernie has a certain cartooniness to him. And by the way, if I'm mentioning a lot of Marvel artists and not too many DC artists, I apologize for that.
No
I
problem.
grew up a Marvel guy, so those are the guys that jump out when I'm
Right.
talking, even though Bernie was more of a DC guy, I guess. But I mean, there were lots of great artists at DC as well. Jim Aparo was fantastic. I loved his Brave and the Bold take on Batman. Later on, George Perez, of course,
Oh,
was good.
yeah.
So, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez,
Absolutely.
fantastic for mostly for DC. So, I don't mean to give those guys short shrift. They're great too, but I just tend to think in terms of
Yeah,
Marvel.
no, I get it. Yeah, well, Neil Adams often associated with DC product too, right? I think maybe more famously, whether Batman, the Green Arrow, Green Lantern, so Deadman. So it's all fair. So tell me a little bit of what you grew up on, the comics that made you fall in love with the art form, as well as when you started to realize that you wanted to pursue being an artist as a career.
Yeah, well, like any kid, I read comic books when I was a little kid. When I was 6, 7, 8 years old, I was pretty precocious when it came to reading. So even at age 6, I was already, my mother was a substitute teacher, and she was already teaching me basic reading skills before I even started school.
That's good.
So even at age 5 and 6, I had basic reading skills, and like any kid, whatever comic was around, I would read it, right? If it was Archie or Casper the Friendly Ghost or Fantastic Four or whatever happened to be around. When I was about 12, a very odd thing, I never thought much about comics. I read them if they were around. If they weren't, I did something else, right?
Yeah.
Go ride my bike around the neighborhood. But when I was about 12, a very odd thing happened. One day, I was walking past my parents' bedroom and I looked in, and there was a stack of comics on their dresser. And apparently, my dad had brought them home. I have no idea why, where he got them, why he brought them home, why they were there. I have no idea. But I went in and I grabbed a stack of comics and I looked through it. And it was a real grab bag. There was all kinds of stuff in there. There was a Superman, remember, there was an issue of Superman, and there was a couple of Archie comics and a few other things. I can't remember. Oh, there was a Turok, Son of Stone, Dell comic in there. But one of the things that was in there was Incredible Hulk number 150. Now, the cover of Incredible Hulk 150 has a motorcycle gang on the cover.
Okay.
And I was really into motorcycles and choppers at age 12. So I was like, oh, this looks cool. I'm going to read about this biker gang, right? So so I read that comic book, and there's this scene where the Hulk, it gets so mad that he literally tears a chunk of a mountainside, like a cliff. There's a cliff, and he literally grabs it and tears it out. And it's completely, you know, impossible. You know, the laws of physics would never allow, you know, this thing to remain in a chunk as he tore it out of the... But, you know, I was like, oh, my God, he tore the side of a mountain out, you know? And I loved that moment, and I immediately said, well, I want to see more of what this Hulk guy does. So I got on my bike, like, immediately after reading it, I hopped on my bike, and I went around to the local, you know, convenience stores and drug stores, and I found issue 149 and 151.
Oh, nice. They had them there. That's cool.
Yeah, because, you know, in those days, stuff would stay on the racks for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took them home, and that was the first time I ever put together, okay, it's issue 149, 150, 151. They come out in order, and you can keep collecting them, right? And so that's the moment I became a collector. And that's the moment that I really started to get inspired to draw for a living. Although at that point, even at age 12, I was already sort of thinking of being a writer as well, which is something I also do quite a bit of. But a few years later, I was doodling in math class, which I did a lot of because I didn't like math. And one of my teachers said, hey, you know, your drawing isn't bad. Maybe you could do that for a living. And I was like, oh, you can draw for a living. Yeah, of course you can draw for a living. And that's when I really kind of decided, yeah, I'd like to become an artist. And of course, I started out, I had a big interest in animation as well. Because I was also interested in acting, and I realized that animation was drawing and acting at the same time. So that's what led me to follow through and go to Sheridan College and take the 3-year classical animation course. And that's sort of what led me into my career.
Cool.
That was long. No, absolutely not.
I love stories like that. I was just thinking as you were talking about it, the last episode I recorded was with Sam Noir and Casey Parsons, and Sam had reached out to me to want to do a top 5 Hulk story, and I thought of you actually because I remember you saying that you were a big fan of the Hulk and you enjoyed drawing him. It was one of the commissions you did for me. What do you think it is about the Hulk that appealed to so many young people at that time? Was it the power? Was it the fact that he was a monster? What was it for you that appealed to you about the character?
Well, you know, I was already kind of into monster movies by then.
Okay.
You know, so I was watching, you know, The Wolfman and Frankenstein and Dracula. And, you know, that was sort of, you know, they call those people the monster kids now, right? Kids that grew up on the, you know, when all these old classic black and white movies were sold to television and all these kids started watching them, and there was a shift in the idea of, hey, who's the hero here? Is the monster the bad guy, or is he the good guy? And we kind of embrace them as the protagonist. And that's, you know, that's something that's, you know, a sort of a noted phenomenon that they call the monster kids, who kind of learn to love these monsters as sort of the hero in a way, even though we knew that they weren't necessary. In the case of Frankenstein, it's a bit of a gray area anyway. But, right. You know, and that's, of course, at the same time when, you know, Count Chocula and Boo Berry and, you know, so advertisers and product makers were taking advantage of that as well. So I was already into monsters. So, you know, the Hulk was an easy step to me. In fact, if you look at the early Kirby rendition of Hulk, he's very Frankenstein-like. You know,
yes.
He's got a more of a flat head with the cropped and a bit more, you know, sort of a little craggier, not quite so square-headed.
Right.
You know, it was clear that, you know, the original inspiration certainly had a little piece of Frankenstein in there.
Absolutely. So
I don't think it was any surprise that kids around my age were getting interested in the character. And also, you know, this idea that, you know, when you're a preteen or an early teenager, you want control of your life, but you don't get much because your parents are still telling you what to do, and you still got to go to school, and you still got to get your grades, and you still got to clean your room, and you know. So there was something sort of like, oh, if I could grow into the Hulk, I could sort of, you know, smash my way out of these constraints that are on me. So I think I liked that aspect of it as well. And yeah. And I mean, he's green.
Yeah.
What the heck?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's as, not matured as a comic fan, but as I've thought about these characters beyond just the superhero motif of they save the day. Like, I grew up Superman, Christopher Reeve Superman. I've got behind me, you know, the Kenner superpower toys, which were my first toys as a kid. So that was that 66 Batman superheroes. But now getting into the bit of the psychology of what these archetypes kind of represent, you start to appreciate certain characters and archetypes a little bit more, seeing beyond just the power or the cartoony aspect of them. And the Hulk is one of those characters who continually has certain layers that I think each decade you add a little bit of something to him that will resonate or appeal to that generation of what they're going through. So like what you were saying, how you want to just break out and have sort of the Hulk was out of control, but it was that feeling of not having control that made him go out of control. Whereas later he had a damaged psyche, and it was somebody that was always in him that was waiting to come out when you get into the Peter David era. So I always like seeing the different ways that these characters can explore that human experience that we're going through. So it's fun to see where people connect to characters at a certain time in their life.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. And you know, there's a lot of sort of, you know, I don't want to get into a whole thing about, you know, what's going on in some comic books fans' minds. But, you know, there's this sort of thing of like, don't change my characters, you know, leave them alone. And I don't agree with that at all. Not every incarnation of a character is necessarily going to speak to me personally.
Right.
But the writers, the younger writers who come up and do things with these characters, whether it's the Hulk or whoever, you know, they're reflecting their experience and they're reflecting their view of the world. Just as the writers, you know, maybe the guys in the Bronze Age wrote a little more simply, or, you know, the Marvel style was a bit more bombastic or whatever. But the best of those writers were still trying to say something about the human condition and what it is to be a hero or a villain. You know, while some of that is a little more gray these days, every generation is going to interpret these characters in a way that speaks to them. And I think that's great. And even if it doesn't, you know, necessarily satisfy me as a reader, you know, there are a lot of people who are going to love it. And, you know, to me, that's the only way to even keep these characters alive. You can't, you know, I mean, the Hulk that I fell in love with would be probably not too meaningful for, you know, some 15-year-old kid today. It's just not going to. It's not going to speak to them in the same way. And why would I want to deny them those characters? Because I love them. So, yeah, reinterpret them. Do something new. Do something different. And I may or may not like it myself. But, you know, if people find something there that they do like or that they can relate to, hey, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I because I've been in that boat sometimes where you kind of see them changing the character or changing something about the character you really love. And, you know, I remember, I always, I as a kid, I remember Peter Parker and Mary Jane being married. That was my normal. For people before me, they're like, Peter's not supposed to be married. So when they did that storyline, I was like, this is, why are you ruining my character? Why are you taking away this thing about him that is, you know, shows his life? He's aging kind of in real time. That was kind of always the cool thing about Peter, is you saw him go through college and then get married. And now it's like, you're erasing it all. And why are you doing, what's the new 52? What are you doing? But you're right, is that I still got, like right now, right in front of me is the Peter David omnibus of the Hulk.
Right.
If I want to read that, no one can take that away from us. It exists. You can read that again and again, and that could be your version of the Hulk, right?
Yeah, this is what confuses me most about these people who sort of, you know, these gatekeepers who want to kind of say, don't mess with them, just keep them the way they are. You know, I mean, to me, that's a stagnant character. And, you know, let's see what somebody else can do with it. And the stuff that Peter David did, now see, here's an interesting fact. I'm not a huge Peter David fan, and I'm not a huge fan of what he did with the Hulk. I like some things he did better than others. I liked his sort of return to the gray Hulk when he goes and becomes a bouncer, you know, in Vegas or whatever he does. That stuff I found pretty interesting. The, you know, the handsome Hulk with the big gun, I could live without that forever. You know,
right.
I'm not a fan of that era of the Hulk at all. But Peter David, his Hulks, his various versions of Hulk, spoke to so many people. Who am I to say that's wrong, or that you should take it away from other people? You know, I mean, it may not all have been my cup of tea, but hey, you know, go for it. And and of course, you know, Dale Kewen, when he came on that book, oh boy, you know, even though I wasn't really necessarily enjoying David's writing, I was buying it because of that artwork, which was fantastic. So
right,
you know, there's always something there for a longtime Hulk fan if you're looking.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that's the best way to be balanced. I think that's the key, right? Is we get, I think the word is propriety for these characters, like, no, yeah. Superman is supposed to be like this, and he has to be married to Lois, and it's like, well, that story still exists. You can read that, and that could be where you stop, and that's it.
Listen, I have a very extensive collection of Hulk comics, and I reread them all the time. And I did buy a lot of the collected version of various different Marvel books and DC books. And I read them all the time. I'm always pulling them out and reading them. So, you know, oh, you ruined my childhood stuff. Like, that's just baloney, man. You're just being a petulant. You're still being a child because, you know, it's not everything is about you, right? So, yeah, those original stories, they're still there. And they're still just as much fun for me to read as they were when I was a kid. And I read them all the time. I've just been rereading Werewolf by Night, which was one of my favorite titles. And again, that was like all the monster titles came out from Marvel, and I was already a monster guy. So, you know, when they did Werewolf by Night and Frankenstein's Monster and Ghost Rider and all those characters back at Marvel, I ate that stuff up. And of course, Swamp Thing over at DC,
mm-hmm.
I just ate it up. And I still reread those comics all the time, and I still enjoy them. So, you know, the stuff you loved is still there, and it's more available than ever. You know, you don't have to go search for back issues. You just buy a collected version of it, and it's all right there. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure what people are complaining about sometimes. But, yeah, nobody ruined your childhood. It's still there. You can still read it and enjoy it.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I think that's the special thing about these characters, is that they live on. You know, eventually Superman's going to be around for 90 years. It's already past the 80-year mark. Things are going to change. People didn't like the John Byrne version of Superman. But for me, I don't like what was before that. That's my, in my head, normal. So to each his own. Enjoy what you like.
All subjective, you know. Just find the stuff you like and just love it. Yeah. That's what I say.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of I don't want to get a hot take from you. That's not why I'm asking this question, but I do like opinions on it just because this year has been there's been so much news and everywhere you look, it's just incessant news, right? What's your take on still appreciating the art but not the artist? Do you think that's possible, or is it too hard to do that sometimes?
Oh, you mean if their sort of personal reputation is besmirched, or well, you know, I gee, that's such a complex question. Let me start by saying this: I'm a huge comedy fan, and I've loved comedy my whole life. And one of the very first big things that I got into in comedy were Bill Cosby's albums.
How could you not?
And you know, it was very, very hard for me. You know, even when I was in high school, I used to do monologues for assemblies, and they were Bill Cosby style monologues. So I loved Bill, and he had a huge influence on me. And he was one of the reasons, along with Steve Martin and Robin Williams, that I ended up getting into comedy. I ended up doing a lot of improv comedy and sketch comedy and writing short plays and all kinds of stuff.
That's awesome.
What's that?
That's awesome. I didn't know that you were
Oh,
writing comedy as well.
yeah, I was very active at theater sports here in Toronto, and I was also part of a sketch comedy troupe called Dangerous Poultry. We used to perform at the Rivoli quite a lot, and we also went and performed at the Edmonton Fringe a couple of times. And yeah, I was really, I don't do as much of it as I do, as I used to, partly because the old man brain doesn't, it's not quite as fast as it used to be for improv. But I still write short plays and comedy, and I'm involved in some play reading groups like Cold Reads here in Toronto, where people get together and read excerpts from new plays or short plays. And so I'm still quite involved with that, although not as much as I used to be. But anyway, just to get back to Bill, it was really devastating for me to find out that he was really a very fucked up guy. And nobody wants to hear that about one of their heroes, and I certainly think that he deserves everything that he got and more. He's clearly really an awful person, and there's nothing about his comedy that is ever going to counterbalance that in my mind. So for me, it's very difficult to enjoy Bill the way that I used to. Now, there are also shades of gray, though. And, sometimes you kind of go, well, what exactly has this person done wrong? And it's not as, with Bill, it's cut and dried. He raped people,
Yeah, I agree with you 100%.
You can't, there's not much of a gray area there. But other people with considerably less, shall we say, egregious crimes, not to say they're good things that these people did, but they're sort of, I mean, they're not necessarily being charged legally the way Bill was, but there's a sort of an ostracization to the point where they say, well, you're not allowed to have a career anymore because you did this awful thing. Well, how awful was that thing, and what's a reasonable response to that thing they did? And I think sometimes right now, and maybe we have to overcorrect before we can sort of find a balance. Don't necessarily argue with that, but I feel like some individuals have paid a higher price than is commensurate with what they did, And I think of, sorry, what's that comedian who became a politician?
Oh yes,
My old man brain.
Al Franken.
Al Franken, thank you. Like in the case of Al Franken, you know, that was that really enough of a crime for people to expect his resignation? I don't know. I'm not saying it was or wasn't necessarily. I'm just saying, did we really weigh it fairly before sort of deciding what the reasonable punishment was? Because that is light years away from what Bill Cosby did. All I'm saying is not that these are not bad things that these people did, but that there are levels of, you know, how bad something is and what's a reasonable punishment or a reasonable amount of backlash compared to what they did.
Yeah.
And so I think sometimes it's not so carefully, clearly equal to the crime.
No, I agree with you on that. I think you hit the nail on the head when you said reasonable. And I think sometimes in this era of correction, which is very important, sometimes we are looking for things or like you said, putting it on the same level because there's an umbrella, right? We have umbrellas where a person could be, five people can all get drunk, but the levels of what they do in that umbrella become very different things, right? Someone could get behind the wheel and what their behavior is going to be very different from a person who says something stupid to a friend and is hurtful. All of them were drunk, right? So we got to, and I think sometimes we get into that. We're being always very careful with what we say because we don't want to now be called out. Oh, you're an insensitive jerk, and I think we need to have the dialogue. And sometimes that's getting lost in this, especially now with all of these things coming out related to comic book creators. I think they're behaving badly and they're being douchebags for sure. But are they Bill Cosby or are they Harvey Weinstein? I don't know about that.
Yeah, I agree. And should they be doing these things?
No.
Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. But is it, like you say, is it, you know, Harvey Weinstein level of egregiousness? And if it isn't, then maybe, you know,
there's differences. There are differences in that.
There are differences. And should some punishment or social pressure be brought to bear? Yes, again, absolutely 100%. But I think the subtleties are sometimes being lost. Anyway, to sort of get back to your original question, mm-hmm. which is, how do I feel about the work of these people now? I make my judgment based on how terrible I think the crime is, right? So in the case of Bill Cosby, I can't listen to his stuff anymore. I can't. It's as much as I loved it and as much of it as it was a huge part of my development as a comedy fan and a comedy performer. I can't, you know, it's tarnished now and I can't enjoy it. And I don't think I should. I don't think I'm really not hoping for the day that I can listen to a Cosby album again. I think I've just put that away and I'm done with that.
Yeah.
You know, in the case of some of these other creators, I'm sort of going, well, I think that he did a shitty thing.
Yep.
But is it a crime? Maybe not. And is it something that he should lose his entire career over? Maybe not. You know, these choices these guys make, where they land on the scale of what's acceptable and what can be forgiven and what can't be forgiven. You know, everybody's got a different idea about that.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying anybody's got the right one or the wrong one. But, you know, for me, I'm going to take it on an individual basis and say, well, that was a shitty thing to do, but I don't think it was a crime in the legal sense. And I don't think it was necessarily a crime in the ethical sense. It's just a shitty thing that somebody did.
Yeah.
And in a case like that, I'm probably going to be a little more inclined to continue to enjoy their work.
Yeah.
Uh, But these are complex questions, and I don't pretend to have all the answers.
No, I don't think any of us do. I think that's why it's interesting to talk about it with people who are experiencing a lot of these same things at the same time. Like I'm a big fan of Bill Cosby myself. The Cosby Show is my favorite sitcom. Me and my wife love it. I grew up on it. That I wasn't sure if I would be able to watch again. And I feel in relation to something like his stand-up, which is much more him in an ensemble thing, I feel, well, he is the main character, but there's a whole cast of people here whose great work is associated with this as well. So should all of them be forgotten because of what he did?
Well, that's another question that you can ask,
right?
You know, and again, these are decisions that individuals have to make on their own. Frank Sinatra was an awful person too.
Right.
I still listen to Frank Sinatra, and I still like it. I think on an individual basis, if you can find a way to continue to appreciate it, I would not say that it's wrong for you to continue to appreciate the Cosby Show. It's not something I think I could do myself, but I wouldn't begrudge anyone the right to do that.
Right. And it's also how we're connected to to these things as well, right? Like your experience with those records and kind of where you hold a person and their influence on you, it affects everyone differently in those matters, right?
It sure does.
Yeah.
I mean, on the other side of the coin, I haven't really been able to watch my favorite Robin Williams movies since his death. And that's a different thing. Because I'm not quite ready to sort of face it.
Right.
He was just as big an influence on me a little bit later in my life than Bill, but he was just as big an influence. And, in that instance, it's the grief mm-hmm. of losing him at such a young age that kind of leaves me unable to face it. So it's an entirely different motivation, but the result is the same. I'm not quite ready to, enjoy it again, mm-hmm. even though I think it's great work. And even though there's nothing clouding his, at least that I know of, there's nothing clouding his legacy. So, I just have to wait until I'm ready. And maybe there will come a day I'll be ready to listen to a Bill Cosby album again. But I don't know about that one.
Do you think there's such a thing as retribution anymore with this culture that we live in, this quick to cancel culture and is it a matter of us getting tired of people so then we pull the skeletons out of the closet, or not in the case of someone like a Bill Cosby, I'm not trying to justify that, but just in general in our mercy, compassion at some point if a person does change, is there retribution still?
Well, yeah. These are some big philosophical questions.
I know you weren't ready for this, but it's just a natural conversation I try to have.
I don't know. I wish that maybe the punishment was more appropriate for the crime. And
yeah.
That's sort of my ultimate take on it. I don't know if I have anything beyond that to add because it's very subjective.
Yeah.
Different have very different views on it. And I don't say that, I wouldn't say that anybody's unjustified in saying, whoever it is,
100%. Yeah.
Comics or entertainment or whatever. If you feel you can still, consume their media and enjoy it, then I don't know if I can argue with that. If you feel that they are, you're just done with them, I certainly couldn't argue with that.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's no right or wrong.
Well, the individuals in question are doing things that are right or wrong.
I'm in regards to how we interact with it is what I mean.
I think everybody's got to be their own conscience.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yes. That's right.
Make your own decisions. And, you know, and ultimately that's all that we can do as individuals is do the best that we can. And, you know, I try to be as even-handed as I can be, mm-hmm. but yeah. I have my prejudices, just like everybody has their prejudices. But I do think that social media does create a bit of a pile-on effect sometimes.
Yeah.
Piles a little, you know, a little transgression is treated pretty much the same way as a larger transgression.
Yes.
Or a huge transgression.
Yes.
And the shades of gray seem to be lost. And that, I think, is unfortunate. But again, you know, maybe we have to overcorrect.
Yeah. Before. Yep.
And I think that's a fair thing, you know.
Part of the process.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, yeah. So I don't know. I doubt I have anything really much more intelligent to say on the matter.
No, that's okay. I just, it's something that I've heard people kind of tiptoe around and talk about, and it is something that interests me to just, with some of the things that have been happening in every aspect of life this year, you know, it's just very topical. And yeah, I'm always interested to see how people interact with that, how they feel, what insight they can give me or anybody else that's listening.
Well, I will say this. I think that unfortunately, and this is something that I've kind of noticed to be true, or at least in my opinion, it's true, is that, you know, privilege begets an expectation of privilege. And, you know, when you start to become famous for whatever it is, for comics or comedy or acting or whatever, or directing or producing, you know, what happens is that people defer and people are drawn, you know, not everybody, but some people are drawn to that energy, that power, that notoriety.
Yep.
And I think what unfortunately happens is it's very hard for people who are on the receiving end of that kind of privilege. It's very difficult for them to sort of, you know, keep their head on straight and go, well, that's bullshit. You know, just because I'm a big actor doesn't mean I deserve all this attention and the perks that come along with that kind of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is you start to feel, well, I've earned it. I deserve it. It's yeah. meant that I should have it. And that's when you get to, that's when you get people like, sorry, we mentioned him earlier, the producer.
Weinstein.
Weinstein. That's when you get people like Weinstein kind of going, well, yeah, of course I came out of my shower with my dick out because somewhere along the line, some actresses, you know, were willing to, you know, make that move to satisfy yeah. that, you know, so it's part of who I am and I deserve it.
Yeah.
And that's when they start to abuse it, right? When it's an expectation of getting that deference rather than, you know, the having it be offered. And that's two very, very, very different things.
Absolutely. So,
and, you know, I think it's very, very difficult when you start to get that kind of power and privilege. It's very difficult to kind of, you know, stay humble about it and go, yeah, I'm not going to walk out of the shower naked with an actress because yeah. that would be wrong.
Right, right.
They lose that perspective, right? They think it's okay.
Yeah.
And that's an unfortunate side effect for many people who gain fame and power and notoriety. And, you know, I'm sure he wasn't like that his whole life.
Hopefully not, but sometimes you see these people, they've got those seeds in them, and that's part of what takes them to where they get to in life. Sometimes you see people who have that sociopath tendency, and a lot of times you see people corrupted by it. They just, their brain can't handle that level of attention. It's that dopamine hit that you're constantly getting if you're a musician on stage and 20,000 right. people are suddenly cheering for you when you used to get booed. Now you feel, I'm getting what I've worked for. This is it.
Yeah.
right? It's very hard for the mind to wrap itself around that, for sure. Yeah.
I absolutely agree. I think no, I think you're right. Some people are damaged to begin with,
Yeah.
and some people are trying to compensate for things.
Yep.
Get them, it kind of warps them, but yeah, I mean, that sort of success, it can really change your point of view about what you deserve and when you deserve it and how much of it you deserve. And you know, I think this is one of the problems with the very rich right now. They feel like, you know, oh, so I made billions, so what? I deserve it. I came up with Amazon and I deserve that money. You're like, well, yeah, but you know, what about the rest of the world? You know, we're all in the same boat and we're all on the same planet and we're kind of wrecking it. So
Yeah.
anyway, we should get back to comics because this is depressing me.
I'm sorry. Let's get back to comics. No, you know, it's good conversation. Sometimes you just got to take it where it's gonna go. That's okay. We can't force it to be unnatural either. I appreciate your insight. It's very refreshing. That's why.
I don't know how insightful I am, but that's as well as I can express myself. That's where I'm at.
No, I appreciate it for sure.
No worries.
I remember you saying the last time we spoke, when I interviewed you the first time, actually, I should say, you said that you saw an animated movie that made you appreciate the fact that this is art and acting. You said that you had been on a date, and that was when it clicked for you. What was that movie that you saw?
That movie was The Rescuers, the Walt Disney movie
Oh, okay.
with the mice who go on the adventure to rescue a little girl. Yeah, I took a date. I don't know how old I was, maybe 17, probably 16, 17, 18, possibly, right around there, just before I got into my 20s. And yeah, I took a date. I had already been involved in little theater and doing comedy at school and stuff like that, so I already had an interest in performing, but I also had this interest in drawing and writing and telling stories. So yeah, I went to see The Rescuers with my girlfriend, and it's this cute movie, but as I was watching it, I started to realize, well, yeah, these are drawings, but these drawings are strung together to create a performance, an acting performance. And I really started to become taken with the idea of being an actor and an artist at the same time. So yeah, that was the movie that did it right there. Not one of Disney's very best movies. It was before the Renaissance that came with Little Mermaid and all of that. But it was a qual it was still a quality job in terms of the animation and the design of the film and the storytelling of the film. So yeah, I was really taken by it, and that's when I started aiming specifically toward getting into the animation business. And so I went to Sheridan College when I graduated from high school, and the rest is history, I guess.
That's all, no, that's cool. I like hearing those little origin stories and those pieces of art that impact you. Like, you don't forget them when they happen, whether or not they age as well as something else might have. It still was that one that led you down that path. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, professionally, I never actually got to animate, never actually got to do animated characters in the style of Disney. Because I ended up working in the layout department, that's the background department. And then I moved on to storyboard revision and storyboard. But in a way, it was almost better because you really had an impact on how the story was going to be told. And even though I've never really worked on anything in my career that I consider to be a great piece of animation or a great show, I was still telling stories visually and drawing for a living, which is, a heck of a lot better than digging a ditch. So, I certainly have never regretted it. And of course, I had a lot of great teachers, both in high school and in college, who helped me get there. And and recently, of course, you know, some great friends like George Eliot, who helped me to bridge that gap in the technological knowledge area and learn at least enough so that I can do the work, even though I'm not adept at the technology by any stretch of the imagination. I still enjoy it.
Right. And I think that's the thing, right? It's the journey of it all. It's seeing where we begin, and you may never get to that place where you had envisioned, but along the way you've gone into all of these interesting places and worked with different people where you didn't maybe think that was going to happen, but there's all of these other things that you experience along the way, which is I think the real meat of it all, right? It's not so much of I envisioned this and it didn't happen, so it's not good. You worked on Ninja Turtles. That's a pretty great thing to have animated. I mean, for me, I loved Ninja Turtles growing up, so that's awesome, in my opinion. And you did live action too. I remember you saying you worked on Saw. You were a horror film or a horror fan growing up, right? You mentioned the monster stuff that you worked on.
Yeah, I can't say that that Saw style of horror is exactly my kind of horror.
Right.
That's, you know, quote unquote torture porn, whatever they call it. But yeah, I'm definitely a horror film fan, and I started working on the Saw movies with Saw 3. Mm-hmm. And they liked my work so much they brought me back for everyone after that. So I worked on 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, which was Saw 3D, which was the last one they made for a while. And they did call me for the new Saw that they made, about a year ago or 2 years ago, or is that even out yet? I'm not even sure.
I don't know what movies have come out or not come out this year.
Yeah, they did a reboot of Saw not too long ago. And they did call me to work on that, but I was already back in the animation business and I was working full time and I wasn't able to do it. But that's how loyal they were to people who a lot of times it was pretty much the same crew coming back again and again for that series. So that was a really important job for me. And actually, unfortunately, when they finished with 7 and they decided not to do any for a while, that was really a big nail in my coffin as a storyboard artist, because it was at least one job guaranteed every year that I could count on. And so it was after that that my income really started to nosedive, and I had to eventually get back into animation. But it was a really, really great group of people to work with, and I worked with three different directors, and they were all terrific to work with, and the rest of the crew were always really friendly. There was a lot of camaraderie, and I fully enjoyed my experience of working on those movies, even though they're not exactly my cup of tea in terms of what I like to see in a horror movie. But it was a great job and great people to work with.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, though. I mean, going from the animation, the storyboards, doing storyboards for live action, I mean, it comes full circle, right? So that's a real blessing. What's next for you? What's something that you want to be able to do in the next couple of years, once all of this 2020 is over? what do you want to do next?
I've been taking advantage of the time I have since I haven't been working. I did start working on a graphic novel.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I got kind of stalled because I did a 12-page sort of prologue to the main story. And when I did it, I was pretty happy with the drawings, but then I started to feel that they had a very old-fashioned look to them, and they do, because, again, I came into comics at a different time, and even though I try to make my stuff look as compelling as I can, it still has that sort of, you know, quote-unquote old-school feel to it. And so I started to sort of feel, I started to second guess the look of it.
Mm-hmm.
So right now I'm sort of mentally kind of retooling and trying to develop a bit of a different drawing style. And that's very difficult to do when you're my age, because you've been kind of drawing the same way for, you know, 45, 50 years. and you you know, you can't necessarily change gears overnight. So I've been trying to, I've been working in my sketchbooks and I've been trying to develop something that I feel has a fresher kind of look to it, but I want to be able to be natural enough with it that it doesn't drift. So it's a kind of a tall order at this stage of my life. And I've been doing lots of other stuff too. I did a faux Hulk Wolverine story, which is a story that I wrote to create samples to try and get work at Marvel many years ago. And I ended up not going with that particular story to do my samples because it didn't have any female characters in it. Mm-hmm. But I had all this time on my hands, and I still like that story, so it's up on Facebook.
Yeah, it looks great. That's a great-looking story. I mean, you comment on your old-school style, per se, but I think it's when it's good, it's good. Like, your stuff is good. It's what comics should look like in a lot of ways, and you're every time people bring up your name, they talk about how much they love the work that you do. Like, you've got a pedigree that people really enjoy, and
I didn't know I was the subject of conversation, so that's nice to know.
Well, I mean, when we're at, you know, comic cons, or when you meet up with people, and I remember one time, I think it was you had done a piece for an artist, and they've done a piece for you, and there was like, I saw it on their table. And there, I love Sam's work. I think it might have been Mike Ruth. I don't want to misquote. Yeah, but he's, you know, he talks highly of your work. And Sam Noir was saying he's a huge fan of. He said he's an enormous fan of your work. That's what Noir actually said. So there's a lot of people who.
Sam is a talented guy in his own right. He's very good, and of course Mike Ruth. Wow, that guy's
right.
That
so
guy never stopped drawing.
No. So these guys, these talented guys who know what's good, hold your work in high regard. So, you know, I completely understand you wanting to retool or refresh them for yourself, but to self-doubt yourself, and I mean, if the story is good, and if you put your heart in it, people are going to enjoy it because they like the way you draw, right?
All right. So, well, that's great to hear, and it's great to hear that some other people are saying nice things about me. Sometimes when you're a cartoonist and you haven't sort of broken through yet, you don't get a lot of positive feedback because you know it's a lonely kind of process, drawing and writing. You know, there's not a lot of interaction with people, so you know, if you're Ken Lashley and you got thousands of fans, you know, you get positive feedback all the time. You know, for us guys who are still kind of toiling away in semi-obscurity, you don't always get a compliment. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate anything else that anybody said about me. That's certainly good to hear.
Yeah, I totally say go for it.
I just want to feel I want to feel that I've put as much as I possibly can into the project. So my plan is to go back and retool it, and I've been working on it on my own time, and also at the same time I've been doing a lot of writing as well. I've been writing a lot of short plays and short stories, and I'm always doing something creative. So, you know, it's been great in a way to have all this time.
Sure.
And I've actually been quite productive. Not all of it is visual, so I can't share that stuff on Facebook. But so hopefully I'm gonna someday get this graphic novel done, and or one of my graphic novel ideas, if not the Parliament Vampire, which is the one that I posted on Facebook. But at some point, hopefully, I'm going to get one of my many graphic novel ideas finished and get it out into the real world, and maybe I'll be able to collect 10 or 20 fans that actually positive feedback.
I think you'll have a lot more than 10 or 20 fans, that's for sure. And people are a big fan of Sam Agro. I know I am.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this conversation today. I hope we can do one again a lot sooner than 200 episodes. Yeah, I'd love to have you on more frequently, that's for sure.
I'm always available.
All right, that's great. And hopefully we get that show in November. It's safe for us to all meet together. I don't know if you'll be there, but I hope you are.
I I have a suspicion that one's going to get canceled, but
yeah,
we'll see how it goes. Plus, I'm in a bit of a, you know, my demographic is not so good with COVID, so even if it happens, I'm not sure I'm necessarily down with going.
That's true.
But,
fair enough.
But we'll see. By November, you never know.
You never know. We got to keep our fingers crossed and be hopeful. Thanks so much, Sam.
Our social distancing.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you.
We should do this again soon, and maybe I'm going to get... I love your reviews that you do. The Happy Sam, the Amused
right.
Sam. I want to get one of those episodes with you, or you give me a couple of different shows you've watched, comics you've read, whatever it might be, and give me all the different versions of Sam and what he feels about those movies.
Absolutely. Anytime, Eric.
All right. Thank you, Sam. I appreciate it, and we'll be in touch.
Bye.